Do you have any heroes?
Yeah, who's your hero?
Who's your hero?
What makes the morality of an antithetical hero so impossible to sustain? Heroes are undoubtedly the embodiment of a culture's values, but there is no one hero to every snot-nosed kid anymore. The core question is, why do our heroes change? What's the future of our heroes? When we're looking at traditional heroes, you know, those who symbolize hope and power and strength, well, a lot of us will think of knights. In the late days of the Renaissance, a young man named Cervantes published his book documenting the venture of a knight, Don Quixote de la Mancha, and it sold 500 million copies worldwide. But in an era of literature consumed by stories of chivalric knights, what made yet another book about knights stand out from the crowd? What made it so incredibly popular? And why do scholars today still consider it the first modern novel? The thing is, Don Quixote isn't really a knight. He's more like a guano gone old man with a running brain who thought it'd be a good idea to arm himself with rusty armor, put a barber's basin on his empty head, and ride his noble ass throughout the land. Don Quixote wasn't yet another formulaic protagonist, saving maidens and slaying savage beasts. He was a complete juxtaposition, a critique of the oversaturated story Cervantes was sick of hearing again and again. Needless to say, he wasn't the best knight. Maybe the worst. Probably. And of course, to match this, he needs probably the worst squire in the land. A peasant, Sancho Panza, who is convinced by Quixote he'll be given riches and a kingdom and subordinates if he joins him on his noble quest. So of course, being the illiterate, gullible man he is, he takes up arms and joins Quixote. And although this podcast is focusing almost entirely on the first volume, it's important to mention that within the second, Sancho truly does receive a governorship over an island. However, he ultimately turns it down to resume his adventures with his friend. Though greed was what motivated him initially. During their ventures, Don and Sancho found many poor souls, you know, desperately in need of a hero. And Don Quixote, valiant knight he was, usually made the situation drastically worse. But not for a lack of trying. You see, Quixote's critical flaw as a character is not his madness or his complete lack of skills in combat. It is the fact he embodies the morality he perceived in knights of Arthurian literature, and failed to recognize that when he brought them into reality, its fragility becomes apparent. Don Quixote aspires for heroism to an extreme, but fails ultimately because of this. All of this to say, Cervantes really hated chivalric romance. They were oversaturated in the literature world, and they were very formulaic. He perceived them as being impossibly good in a morally turbulent time. Pulitzer Prize finalist and author Elif Bautman sums it best as, "The first modern novel was already a product, even an expression of negative criticism. Don Quixote contains a quite explicit critique of the chivalric romance and its insufficiency to account for the real way it feels when you wake up in the morning in 17th century Spain." So what does this say about heroes as a whole? Well, ultimately, while on a piece of paper a knight in shining armor can be a hero, there's a need to be critical in reality. Heroism is not universal, and there's no one-size-fits-all. From a grounded perspective, the first modern interpretation of heroism could not be more critical of heroes, and the novel resonated with audiences for a similar reason, leaving the old world and entering a new one. Chivalry is now dead, and nobility is perpetually futile. The future was anything but bright for the average 17th century Spaniard. But where do we go from here? If the old heroes are dead, who will be the new ones? A short hop, skip, and an incredibly cheesy song takes us to the 1990s. The words greed and good are echoing throughout the American capitalist system. Division between the economic classes is a gaping chasm. Jack Lucas, a shock jock, is on top of the world. He lives lavishly in his NY apartment, with a successful radio show and drinking Dom Perignon in his obnoxiously large bathtub. Until one of his callers, by Jack's fault, commits a mass murder-suicide, killing dozens of innocent people, which obviously doesn't make Jack look like a great guy. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with The Fisher King, not the obscure 90s cult classic film, The Arthurian Legend, The Fisher King is the holder of the Holy Grail, who is maimed by his own spear to the groin. Now, Jack doesn't get his cut off, but the same can't be said for his career and his dignity. Cut to 3 years later, Jack's broke, depressed, and currently on a wild bender. He's about to be set on fire, I'm not exaggerating, by a couple of average New Yorkers. When from the shadows, a knight in rags and covered in garbage he found on the streets somehow saves him. This is El Quixote, who goes by Parry. On the surface, he's your average insane homeless guy, but as Jack will soon find out, Parry isn't just any insane homeless guy. Parry is a victim of the mass shooting Jack instigated, but Parry's seemingly ignorant of this. His mind's dried up like our former Don Quixote de la Mancha. His reality is contorted similarly. The streets of NY are now a land of fantastical beasts and daunting red knights in his eyes. But beyond this, he's convinced that Jack is some prophesied hero, destined to help him retrieve a tacky trophy to which Parry's convinced himself is the mythical Holy Grail. From this point forward, Jack embodies the character of Sancho, convinced that if he helps Parry reform, he can regain his career the same way Quixote's squire believed he could gain wealth and power. Basically, they both start off the quest motivated purely by greed, and it's clear Jack still wants his old life of extravagance back. He maintains this attitude right up until the climax of the film, where Parry falls into a catatonic state as memories of his past life and subsequently his wife's death begin to manifest as the Red Knight, a hallucination symbolic of his trauma. But at this point, Jack gets the opportunity to regain his old life, just as Sancho gets the opportunity to govern an island. But he relents and ultimately completes Parry's quest, retrieving the Grail and accidentally saving the overdosing architect's life by tripping an alarm in the process. But what does this say about heroes and their morality? Well, if we take a look at Joseph Campbell's deconstruction of the hero's journey, Jack's quest with Parry lines up pretty nicely. The refusal of the call to adventure and the belly of the whale can be seen very clearly at the beginning of his arc when he reluctantly accepts Parry's mission. Further, the apotheosis as he turns down his career for Parry's sake. And finally, at the end of his journey, he truly does become the master of two worlds and gains the freedom to live. All of this to say, the act of redemption is key in the archetypal hero of an uncertain time, as this attempts to reconcile with the socio-economic travesties of the American capitalist system. The dichotomy between Parry and Jack illustrates the divide between the homeless and upper class. The hero was subsequently framed as a reflection of the problems America had, but ultimately was capable of overcoming their flaws, like the blind eye towards poverty and their stratification of social classes. But change never came. There was no mass reforms, there was no class convergence, and there was no more heroes. If you're familiar with Joker, it's a pretty surreal thing that we'd be talking about in relation to heroism. But in 2019, Todd Phillips' interpretation of the character resonated with a surprising amount of audiences. So why the hell does this archetypal, golden era villain resonate so heavily in our culture? And why do so many glorify him as the symbol of justice? Arthur Fleck is a rundown carny in Gotham City. He lives with his aging mother, who's clearly got a thing for the billionaire Thomas Wayne, an upper-class snob who she used to work for. Arthur begins a downward spiral as he loses his job for taking a revolver to a children's hospital and kills three Wayne employees on the train home after. The lower class quickly adopt him as a symbol of inequality, and riots consume the city. Meanwhile, Arthur performs a botched comedy routine where he makes a clown of himself. Yeah, I'm about as funny as he is. Somehow a clip of him reaches the Murray Franklin show, where his idol and not-so-subtle father figure mocks him for his terrible routine. At this point, Arthur's kind of going off the rails. Then we delve into the subplot where he's convinced Thomas Wayne was his father, but ends up taking two steps backwards when he finds out his mum wasn't even his biological parent. But Arthur, being the totally mental state person he is, mercilessly smothers his mother to death in a hospital bed. Of course, the next rational move in Arthur's head is going on live TV and blowing out his brains in front of Murray. He dons the classic makeup, and after a dance routine and a police chase, a totally normal sequence of events, somehow manages to make it to the set. After making a series of untasteful jokes and being berated by his hero, Arthur makes a last-minute change of plans. He launches into a rambling speech in which he repeats his mantra, his desire to be seen, acknowledged, and recognized. Being treated like shit every day doesn't make the docile madman Parry anymore. It creates evil men like Arthur. He then, in a fit of rage, shoots Murray through the face. We then cut to the climactic finale, finding Arthur in the backseat of a police car, which is almost immediately run off the road by a rider in a truck. Barely lucid, Arthur stands on top of a car surrounded by fires and looters as he grins a bloody smile, finally seen. So, to the average person, Arthur's that guy you see on the bus and stay as far away as you possibly can from him. His actions are abhorrent, and he shows little remorse for the lives he takes. So why the hell are there so many people who idolize him? Well, mostly, the tale can be pinned on the arse of the American political climate and its capitalist system. Arthur Fleck is the epitome of the modern psychologically unstable male. His profile matches so heavily to that of modern American mass shooters, the controversy surrounding the film on its release was monumental. A similar reaction can be seen with lower class citizens in places with a little bit overly controlling governments. The eat the rich mentality of the film undeniably resonated with the audience at the time of release. In Lebanon, Iraq, Chile, Bolivia, Hong Kong, and Spain, Joker iconography could be seen at protests. Joker's unique to our time, and it reflects the turbulence in our modern political climate. But is this the course our heroes will follow? Are we inevitably going to see more flawed heroes and even more sympathetic villains? We'll have to wait and see. Heroism is ultimately completely subjective. There was an archetypal hero once, which appealed to almost everyone of a similar background, like we see in the Arthurian text, which kickstarted this line of appropriation. But as our world changed, developed, and eventually became more educated, a moral uncertainty permeated throughout all cultures. The idea of heroism is far from universal in a world where thousands of individuals have respective ideologies, religions, and beliefs. So I'll ask again, who's your hero? Because your hero is pretty unlikely going to be my hero, or the person to the right of you, or the person to the left of you, or maybe even in the whole entire room. So choose wisely. Thanks for listening, and drink water and wear a mask.